Hundreds of millions of people live in the extremest conditions of poverty. And often, much of what we discuss at VoxDev, standard programs like microfinance, skills training, agricultural extension, can actually miss those at the very bottom of the income distribution. There is one approach that, based on the existing evidence, promises to be particularly effective at both reaching that group and helping to lift them out of poverty. But can it be delivered at scale to match the scale of poverty in our world today? Welcome to Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev, and my guest today is Stephanie Brockerhoff, who is the Director for Program Design and Impact for BRAC's Ultra Poor Graduation Initiative. Stephanie, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Thanks for having me.
So, BRAC is widely ranked as the biggest NGO in the world, depending on how you define that ranking exactly. For those who don't know it, what is BRAC and what does it do?
As some of your listeners might know, BRAC was initially founded in the early 1970s. And became a very large development organization within Bangladesh over the next two decades or so. What's kind of unique about BRAC is that we look at poverty in a holistic way, knowing that not one sector alone is sufficient to tackle the many challenges that people in poverty are facing. So BRAC was working in education and health, social assistance, livelihoods. It was setting up social enterprises to address challenges in the value chains, and it was also working in microfinance. And then in the early 2000s, BRAC started to also work internationally, initially starting in Afghanistan. And by now, we estimate that we've reached around 145 million people in about 15 countries across the world.
And at BRAC, you're working specifically on the Ultra Poor Graduation Initiative. What exactly is a graduation program and what are the key ingredients to that?
Yeah, so the graduation program is a package of interventions that is really delivered to people in extreme poverty in a sequence and time-bound manner, right? So the idea is that people who are really poor need a more holistic and a bigger set of investment than normal people and any of the sort of piecemeal or individual interventions that other programs deliver are insufficient to help this set of people. So what it usually consists of is a large investment, often in the form of an asset, a livestock, or some sort of productive asset into an income-generating activity. There is a basic support to meet basic needs to ensure that people do not sell off their livelihoods. And then there is ongoing intensive coaching and mentoring and skills training. And all of this is delivered typically during about 24 months.
And could you tell us a bit about the origin story of this approach and why BRAC decided to develop this and expand it?
Yes. So in the 1990s, research in Bangladesh were sort of finding that the poorest of the poor were not being reached by any of the existing programs. And when BRAC looked into that, they realized that that is in fact the case, right? And that the poorest of the poor are often invisible. So it is something that unless you explicitly go looking for them and explicitly design programs that reach them, you often miss them. And at the time, there were ideas that microfinance might solve this or social assistance might solve this. But what BRAC then started to do is really think about what are the specific challenges that this group of people is facing. One of them is just finding them, reaching them and targeting them and bringing them into programming. But the other one is that, as I was already sort of alluding to in my previous answer, they face a mirage of challenges, right? So they face many very specific barriers and vulnerabilities that other households do not face. And this is where the graduation program came from, which says in order to really put these households on a trajectory out of the extremist poverty and enable them to sort of take part in community and have productive livelihoods, you need to provide them with more than what we are traditionally doing. And this is where this multifaceted intervention comes from. And crucially, also this idea of providing longer-term support with wraparound coaching, but also access to a productive livelihood.
And in terms of your own route to working on this, you were previously at Oxford Policy Management, where I imagine you had insight into the various governments' attempts to implement social protection programs. What were some of the things that you would see going wrong in those attempts?
Yeah, I think this is a very interesting question, no? Because first of all, just to say, there are lots of really great social assistance and social protection programs out there. But one of the things that I kept on seeing is that a lot of these programs weren't designed from the beginning to be run and implemented by governments. So they were often designed by highly financed PMUs, where civil servants would get top-up salaries in order to participate, or they would be implemented by highly paid development organizations who would be running those, often with expats. And often universities from the US or the UK would be providing fancy methodology around indices to trigger various things. And when it came to scale up or hand over to government, a lot of this fell apart, right? And why, in my mind, a lot of this happened because it wasn't designed bearing in mind what type of staff government would be able to afford and attract to run these programs, right? It was designed to meet sort of donor log frames and scoring. And afterwards, when things were handed over to government, they often needed to be almost redesigned, right? And I found that quite frustrating after a while, to be honest. And the other thing that attracted me to BRAC is that I did a lot of work supporting governments in developing social protection policies. And the idea of graduation programs, where you provide a bigger investment into households for a specific period of time, is something that a lot of governments are really interested in doing, but also really struggle to think through how to do well themselves, right? So there's this global evidence. It is very attractive as a instrument within your social protection strategy. But a lot of the governments really struggle to understand, A, what it is. It's not just about getting people off cash transfers, but B, also, even if they understood what it is, how to then make it work within the existing resources. So both of this then led me to join BRAC and, try to support governments in thinking through how to do this more effectively.
Yeah, and your approach at BRAC, as I understand it, you already kind of mentioned some of these ingredients of the graduation program, right? And at BRAC, instead of kind of holding all of those ingredients constant across the various countries you work in, you try to hold the impact you're aiming for constant and then adjust the design around that based on kind of the local context and what works in a given setting. Could you walk us through how exactly that works in practice?
Yeah, maybe I can start by just explaining one thing about the model itself that I think not all of your listeners might know. Graduation programs are all about changing outcomes for the participants. So unlike a lot of programs that we deliver, where especially that governments deliver, where there is a tendency to count what you are delivering, graduation programs are defined by whether households at the end of the programming period have hit certain indicators of success, right? And these typically map onto the multidimensional poverty that we discussed at the beginning and the many barriers that the program is set to tackle. And only if participants' lives have changed across all of these dimensions is the program a success. So when I say things like trying to hold the impact of the model constant, that's what I mean, right? We need to make sure that the program still delivers that type of impact, right? But what we and others did at first is to focus a lot on tailoring the program technically to another context, right? So some of the barriers that the program was designed to tackle in Bangladesh are not relevant in other countries in the world that we're working with, right? But there will be other things, like, for example, in South Africa, where we work, there's a big issue of GBV and so on, and violence that needs to be tackled. But some of the things that the program in Bangladesh tackled are less relevant, so the social exclusion being an example of this. So a lot of the time, initially, when people were supporting adaptation globally, they focused on this technical adaptation. What we are now trying to do is basically building on something that also Imago and others have been making popular in their book, Scaling Up Development Impact, which is the strategic triangle that says, in order for an intervention to scale, you need to really do three things. Firstly, of course, you need to technically tailor it, right? It needs to work within the context. And a program like the graduation program particularly is all about the context and the local barriers. So you need to spend time on that. I'm not saying you don't. But then if you want governments to be able to deliver this, there are two other dimensions that are really important. The first one is what I call sort of political feasibility, right? It has to fit into the political agenda. It has to be something that is politically interesting, right? As a result of that, graduation programs are now graduation programs that we are supporting, or governments that we are supporting to design and implement these programs, call graduation programs all manner of different things. In some countries, it will be a youth program, and in others, it will be a rural poverty program, and others, it's a social assistance program, right? It's about tapping into what is politically feasible, because you need that political support if you want scale and funding. And then the third one, which is what we spent a lot of our time on, is the administrative deliverability, right? And this sounds a little bit opaque, but what I mean by that is we need to design programs that governments can deliver through the existing resources and capacities and systems, or capacities and systems that we can realistically build within a manageable period of time or within the resources that are available. And when those three things come together, you have the ingredients of scale and success. So what we are now trying to do is, we're no longer trying to say, you have to hire these type of coaches and they have to do exactly this and they need to have exactly this qualifications, et cetera. But we're trying to say, look, you have to achieve this type of impact for participants. These are the key ingredients that go into a program. As I mentioned at the beginning, there has to be an investment into productive livelihood. There has to be intensive coaching that includes both skills training, but also mentoring and accompanying the behavioral change journey. And there, in most cases, has to be some kind of consumption support so that people don't sell off the asset. But what you can think about how to do is you can think about how you best operationalize that within your existing resources. And we'll help you think through how to do that. We'll help you think through what the evidence tells us about what is possible and what works. We'll help you think through how to operationalize the model so that it suits your context, your resources, and then we'll help building the systems and the capacities needed to do that at scale.
So linking to that point, it seems like what you do is you start from where governments already are and you look to anchor the graduation program onto some sort of existing program, be that a cash transfer or a livelihoods program or a youth employment initiative. And that means that you're almost treating this as a coordination problem rather than just a funding problem. Could you give us a concrete example of what this looks like in a specific country?
So this is indeed very often what we are doing, because it is obviously a very attractive value proposition to governments as well, right? To say, we will build on what's there. Let's look across the map of what you've already got. Most of the ingredients of a graduation program are already in place. This is not about finding lots of different investment. A good example of this is what we're doing in South Africa, where we are doing this targeting child support grant recipients of the social grants and layering additional interventions onto these participants that they would normally not receive, right? So we are bringing in productive assets from the economic cluster so that there's investments into livelihood, there's skills training. We are ensuring that they're receiving coaching. And all of this is packaged together, or as we call converged, out of existing government investment. And it is layered onto the same participants, but governments typically do not like to layer that much, right? And prefer to give different interventions to different households, right? So it's about making the case that layering is important, helping different government departments, some of whom do not currently reach those parts of the population to reach those parts of the population, but also to reach them in an effective way, right? So you need to provide different type of training on livelihoods to these type of households than to others, right? So there's an element of helping different departments understanding that, and then providing the coaching and mentoring. And as you say, that also then becomes de facto a project management and or coordination problem, which sounds very trivial, but is probably the hardest thing for governments to do, to work across the different silos, right? So that is one thing that we're seeing. However, there are also two other things that we are seeing governments do. The one is design standalone programs. So some of the governments we are partnering with have looked at all of this and said, no, this convergent layering, this is too complicated. I'm just going to make resources available and we'll design a standalone program. So that then does require that new investment, but it has the advantage that you don't have to then deal with the coordination challenges and you have ring-fence funding and sort of more control by the lead agency implementing. So that is, in the end, a political decision. And then the third thing we're also seeing governments do is that some of them have existing programs, existing graduation program or existing livelihood programs. And what they are asking for help with is improving these programs and turning them into sort of quality graduation style programs. So this might mean you already have a livelihood program, but maybe the asset is too small to have a real impact. Or you have a livelihood program and coaching, but the coach only comes before the asset and then never visits you again. So when you run into a problem with your asset and the asset starts to fail, there's no support. So then we help build out that program. So it's really these three type of approaches. And I think this is a good example, right? Because I was trying to say, we're trying not to be prescriptive. We're trying to go with where the government is at, trying to minimize the new investment if that is a challenge, but also go with the route that government wants to go, right? So if it's about improving something, we'll help you improve it. If it's about leveraging what you have and layering, we will help you with that. And if you want to design a standalone program, we will support you in doing all of that, right? And rather than saying, you know, standalone is the only way to go, right? And I think as a matter of principle, like putting this government ownership and what is politically desired at the heart is just really good for sustainability and also drive and also ownership of the whole design process and the challenges that come with it. Because all of these three approaches have their own challenges de facto, right? It's just a question of which one you pick.
I think this is something that I hadn't really appreciated before, is that BRAC's role here is almost as a thought partner to governments who are looking to improve the effectiveness of their social protection programs and are willing to put money behind that. For listeners used to NGOs who are acting as implementers on the ground, what is a team like yours actually working on and doing day to day?
Yeah, I mean, maybe just to say before I answer your question that there are still parts of BRAC that are directly implementing, right? So it's not to say that we don't do that ever, right? And I think just like there is no one way to sort of help governments scale graduation programs, there are still many contexts where it makes sense to implement directly, right? So if we are serious about saying that government ownership and government leadership is key, then we are looking for sort of contexts where there is a certain degree of capacity, you know, government capacity, and government has access to resources. Those could be domestic, but they could also be development resources, right? So, and really what we're trying to say is that in the cases where that is there, right, and government does want to lead, then NGOs should really, like us, should operate as a thought partner rather than doing parallel programming, right? So what we're trying not to do is that when you have a government that could do all of those things, implement a traditional sort of graduation program with parallel structures, but rather what we're trying to do is be a thought partner that thinks through how to leverage what's there, helps strengthen the system and the capacity of the government to operate. And we will really work as a partner in the background, right? So the shape this takes can be very different, right? Like, so sometimes we're providing, we'll be providing support and thinking through how to design the program, what does the evidence tell us, what are the different trade-offs of what the evidence tells us, what of these trade-offs do you want to make, which of these trade-offs do you have to make, you know, then we might be augmenting a capacity of government, both at the national, at the local level, but always with the emphasis on making sure that we don't implement for government, but we build their machinery to run and manage this program over time, right? So a key part of this also means that you are operating at the speed at which government is willing to go at those times, right? And sometimes this can be uncomfortably fast, right? So I was telling you earlier on that one of our partner governments wants to design a standalone program and it wants to do all of this in 2 months, you know? So, you know, sometimes this also means you just have to go with the pace at which government wants to go in this moment. So we augment capacity sometimes, but with the view of building that machinery and figuring out the administrative capacity that is needed, building that and both for implementation and for design. We provide technical assistance to help think through, and we also support the creating of the sort of enabling environment of that will allow graduation to sort of persist at scale, which is often like policy work or framework work. So it's really driven by the context and the type of support that the government partner is asking for, right? With a view of sort of trying to take a bit of a systemic view of poverty programming in the country, right? Which a lot of the civil servants we work with do anyways, that think through, okay, like, you know, first of all, you need the authority to act in all of this, right? So you need to have sort of high-level government or high-level policy support. And sometimes this might need to be enshrined in a policy. But then you need to also work on like ensuring that all of the people at the lower levels understand what they're meant to do, buy into this, and then eventually have the skills, right? And we're supporting sort of all of this process. But yeah, we're trying not to implement ourselves. We are not funding any program components, right? I think this is maybe the biggest difference to sort of traditional NGO work, but also traditional development work. I think in the past, we very often said, okay, government is leading all of this, but they don't have money for the coaches. So the coaches will be funded by, I don't know, you know, FCDO or the World Bank or something, right? And then at the end of the pilot, you haven't actually solved the biggest hurdle to government running and scaling, right? So the one sort of really hard line is this, like, not funding program components and rather saying, okay, we need to find the program components, even if they become sort of the quality components over time. And what we will focus on helping you access those, helping you build them out, helping you think through where they could come from, supporting you in talking to the ministries of finance, et cetera, all of those type of things, right? But we are not going to really fix the issue of quality programming by short-term solutions, funding part of the components, because that means we're not working on the hard issue of finding a solution for how that will be in place in the long term.
And in the countries where you work, I mean, many of them, all of them will have existing social protection systems or anti-poverty programs of some kind. How does graduation fit around what already exists? Are you looking for governments to adopt it instead of current programs, on top of them? And how do you try to manage the politics of that type of change to policy?
This is obviously a very sort of hot potato topic, no? I think the way we try to approach this also, because, I mean, we are partners of governments who have all of their own sort of politics, their own constitutions, you know, in many of the countries where we work, social protection is a right enshrined in the constitution, and others it's not. It's very contested. The way we typically try to position this is to say graduation is one instrument within your social assistance offering, right? It's not the only thing you can or should be doing. It works. We have evidence that it works, you know, but it also is probably best suited for a certain category of people, right? So if you're old and really fragile, You know, is a graduation program really the best route for you? Probably not, no? A social assistance, a cash transfer program is a better way to support someone in that category. So we're really trying to say, and I think this is how a lot of governments anyways think about it, like you have different social assistance and different social protection tools for different parts of your population. And here is one. It's kind of a little bit different in the sense that, like, obviously traditional social assistance programs provide smaller amount of supports for a longer duration of time that is very instrumental in alleviating poverty. But it has a different objective to the graduation program, where the objective is obviously to provide a time-bound, bigger investment into a household with the idea that after this 2 years, you do not have to come back to support that household because you have successfully lifted them over a certain threshold, which enables them to continue to prosper and help themselves. Not that they've, you know, graduated out of poverty, but they've graduated out of the trap that is holding them back, right? So we're really trying to sort of explain and position graduation as one of those instruments and also really explain who it is for and when it makes sense to provide a graduation program versus another program. And I personally think this other debate that happens very often is like it's like a little bit of a red herring, you know, like should we give cash directly? Should we do cash transfers? Should we just do graduation? The truth is governments face a multitude of different challenges. They have lots of different populations. They have constitutions, right? And what we should be focusing on is providing them with good policy options, right, that can then be used and tailored to the context. And I think that's very much the way we are approaching it and trying to stay out of the politics around all of these things.
You've referenced a couple of times so far this evidence base, which shows that the graduation model works. One common issue in development is that the evidence that is generated is often generated on an NGO delivery model and often in relatively ideal conditions with very talented staff and good managers involved in the process. But then if a program is scaled up and delivered by government, the group of people implementing it is different. And sometimes that can mean that the impacts that you see in this pilot or RCT don't really translate when the government, which is a big, much bigger, more complicated organization, is trying to implement a program at scale. I was wondering what your thoughts are on that and whether you see the evidence from these kind of smaller trials holding up at scale.
This is a really good question, no? And I think it's a really life question also. I think what the evidence that we have shows us is that the model works, right? So the approach works. That is a big thing, right? Because for many, many other programs, we don't have that, right? So we know that if we do it well, it works and it can be really transformative. So I think that is a really big thing to hold on, right? The question to what extent all of the findings from the often NGO pilots are one-on-one applicable to government or can be one-on-one replicated by governments is something that I think a lot of people are thinking about at the moment. And we are starting to see some evidence come in from government-run graduation programs now. And it looks very promising, no? So we've got, obviously, evaluation of various programs in Sahel. We've got evaluations of program in Paraguay and Nicaragua. We have evaluations of the government-run graduation program in Bihar. And all of them are showing that governments can replicate these type of results. I think for me, the main question is twofold, right? Firstly, I think it takes longer to get the program design right for governments, right? So what we are currently focusing on is helping support getting the program design right. And then once the program design is settled and you're delivering all of those components, then it makes sense to do these RCTs and do these evaluations. And actually, you're seeing that, right? Some of the programs that are now being evaluated, they've been there for a while, right? And they're being evaluated once the design has sort of settled. So I think the main research gap is around not what works, right? We know sort of what works, even though we can talk about to what extent that is often easy for governments to understand, right? There's a big gap between evidence and evidence use. And I think we play a big role in trying to translate the evidence and help a government understand, so what question of like all of these studies that are coming out. But we, where the real research gap for me lies is in the how, you know, how can governments operationalize graduation in many, many different ways, having a similar impact to NGO-run programs, right? And we're seeing evidence emerge out of that, right? So in some parts of the world, they're leveraging community-based organizations, and others, they're piggybacking on their social protection infrastructure. We're seeing program adaptation in urban contexts, which realize that urban livelihoods are very different, that the program duration might have to be shorter or longer, depending on your context. So we're seeing a lot of the thinking through on the how. But in my mind, it's the question of how do governments operationalize it to have the same type of impact where the bigger research gap exists. We are starting to see impact. We are starting to see evidence that they can, you know, so that it does work when they're doing it at scale. And actually, we've developed an evidence map that you're together with the LSE that your listeners might be interested at looking at, which goes through all of the different studies that we are aware of and shows really the wealth of the evidence that we have been generating. And a lot of it is now also coming from government-led graduation programs. Or there's also obviously the Partnership for Economic Inclusion that is also trying to distill the evidence base around that. No, but it's a very good question, no? And also sometimes just a question of, okay, so what does it tell me when there is the study about coaching in Niger? How does that translate to my context in Indonesia? No, what does it actually tell me? How do I replicate some of this? Right, there's a lot around just evidence use and how to make the most of the wealth of information we do have.
Yeah, I'm pulling on that thread a bit more. So you've referenced there, kind of, there are now some studies that are looking at impact when a graduation program is implemented by a government. I guess in your work, you're probably not running an RCT every time you go into a setting and work with a government on graduation. So I'd be interested in how you are tracking the impact of the work that you and your team is doing.
Firstly, and this might sound like a bit of a sort of pedantic point, but it's actually really important because these are government programs, right? It's really also up to them to do the sort of impact evaluations of their work. And a lot of them actually do want this, and a lot of them actually require it also as part of new programming or to access more funding and so on. So I think we are starting to see some of this, and governments are a bit different in terms of whether they require this or not. So it's not something that we don't see happening, right? I would say we only really need RCTs when we are doing something new, right? So, and we are actually supporting governments and doing quite a few new things, right? There's quite a few urban programming. Governments are also interested in employment pathways, which is something that hasn't been studied, you know, both urban and employment. It's fairly new. So there will definitely be a need for RCTs or impact evaluations of a lot of these things. What we are trying to focus on at the moment is really that operational research, right? Quick operational research and insights that help us figure out whether the design and the implementation is working, doing course corrections, right, immediately to settle the design. And only when that is settled does it actually make sense to do impact evaluations, right? Because otherwise you just sort of contaminate your design. And as I was trying to say earlier, it takes longer to get that right with government. If you are working within existing resources, you're trying to figure out, are these the right coaches, or is this workforce better at coaching? You do the layering or the convergence model, to go back to a South African example, and you're partnering with one department, and then you realize this department is maybe not the right partner. So you partner with another one, and then maybe that is now the right one, et cetera, right? So until we have settled the model, right? The model for how government is implementing graduation, it makes sense to wait with the impact evaluations, but there's a huge research need to accompany this type of work, right? luckily, I think the graduation program, back to a point I made at the beginning, always has this little built-in security blanket that allows you to check impact, right? Because your participants are going through the program and you are tracking whether their lives are changing against the outcomes that I mentioned at the beginning, right? So even if you don't have an impact evaluation, you have a live sort of tracker that allows you to show, that allows you to see whether the program is working for participants, because you're always measuring the outcome and the impact of your interventions at the end anyways, right? So it's not the same as an impact evaluation. It's also not the same as an impact evaluation 2 years after the end of a program, but it does give you a very good early warning sign of whether you are really going down the wrong track, and it allows you to course correct and adapt the program at any time, right?
So going into the ingredients of graduation in a bit more detail, the coaching function that's involved seems to be particularly important, right? And it also seems particularly hard to do at scale. I imagine that most governments don't have small armies of highly trained, highly motivated frontline workers who could play that kind of coaching role, just lying about ready to be used. Is that a role that AI and AI chatbots could help to play in terms of the advice that's laid onto these programs? Or do you feel that this still requires a human touch?
I think the short answer is definitely requires a human touch, right? The question is like, how big does that human touch have to be, right? And I think you're completely right in saying this is a real barrier to scaling quality graduation programs, probably any frontline service, right? It is a big challenge, right? Like governments do not have access, or they cannot afford endless frontline service delivery workforces that are highly trained and highly motivated, et cetera, no? And also the graduation model was built around highly motivated NGO caseworkers, no? So it is one of the key things in my mind that we are supporting governments to rethink. Not everywhere in the world, because in some cases, governments do have access to this type of workforce, but in a lot of places they don't, and the distances are very far. You know, Bangladesh is, everyone is very close together, and like other parts of the world, use to travel 5 hours to get from one village to the next, right? So you really need to rethink that sort of coaching function. And also, when I first started working on graduation, it's like you just hear coaching, and coaching is so important, right? Like, what is it? What are we even talking about, right? We're lumping so many things into one, right? Basically, there is the hard skills training, right? The graduation program involves livelihood-specific training, where participants learn around the livelihood. They get help in troubleshooting around the livelihood, right? But then there's also psychosocial support. There's working with households around trauma and getting them into a better mindset around empowerment and all of these aspects. There's financial inclusion aspects around saving. And then there's the ongoing mentoring and support, and what I sometimes call like the behavioral change journey that households are being on, right? So all of us, whenever we try to change anything about ourselves, we get like 5 apps that we sign up to. We get like trainers. We ask our friends or partners to remind us to do this. It's difficult to change the way you operate, and even harder if you live in really bad circumstances, and as a lot of the participants that governments are working with who've completely lost the belief that things can change for them, right? Like, so the coaches at the moment, all of this is lumped into one sort of thing called coaching. And it's actually even worse, because a lot of the monitoring and data collection is also often done by these coaches, right? So what we've then tried to do when we started working on this is to disentangle this a little bit, right? Which of these functions are actually transactional, right? Which of these are relational, so to your human touch? Which of these are skilled functions, and which of these are actually empathetic functions, right? Like a good coach, a good mentor is not always the most knowledgeable person on a certain topic, right? And how often do you actually need coaching support to reach households for it to be effective, right? So you need, and we we looked across sort of the evidence, back to that point about the evidence, and tried to develop what we call a coaching framework, which was also available online, that sort of tells us about what the evidence says works in terms of coaching and where technology can be used to replace some of this and what the trade-offs are of the different elements, right? And I think technology will play a large role in my mind, freeing up the humans to do the bits that only humans can do, and to use technology to do some of the other stuff, right? And one of the things we at Bruck are working on is that we are developing a graduation platform, which we are developing as a digital public good in cooperation with the Center for Exponential Change in India and the South African government, which is basically a co-pilot function, right? And what the idea is that coaches will have this in their pocket and it helps them make the task easier, right? So they have access to material, they have access to training, they have access to other experts. Some of the data entry is facilitated and made easier, all of these things that you're alluding to, right? And I think we're also seeing a lot more group coaching happening by necessity of government. To your AI question, I think the main thing about technology in general, and that also applies to AI, is that it has to be in the service of the participant, right? So I'm very open in thinking through how to use all of these. And I know that some other organizations are already using chatbots, right, that participants and coaches can talk to. And I think it's a good idea. You could also imagine coaches getting feedback based on AI listening in. You could imagine training of coaches being developed by uploading the training program. There are lots of things that we could imagine where AI could be really helpful, right? You could imagine apps that help you diagnose sort of what's wrong with the livestock or with your crop, right, in the way that they exist for houseplants. There are lots of potential opportunities that I think people get very excited about. What I often say with this, and including for our own project around the graduation platform, is that we're trying to get the foundations right first, right? Making sure that there's a proper MIS, making sure that there's proper data, making sure that the day-to-day functions of the coach are supported, making sure that we don't overload the coach with lots of things that others could be doing, right? Making sure that there is that personal relationship element between a coach and the participant, and then building out from that, right? But I think technology will, in my mind, never replace the human touch. But the question of how often and does the human touch have to be, and what for, right? And what can be replaced, and where could participants actually receive better support because they would have access to more support and maybe even higher quality support if we also include AI chatbots, but also less fancy things like YouTube videos, you know, that are also on the platform that people can watch. Or, I mean, this obviously assumes people have connectivity, but in some of the urban contexts they do. There are lots of things I think we can think through there. And there are a lot of discussions about this topic at the time. I think the main thing is just we need to remember who this is for, right? And that it has to help the participant have a better experience, and that we don't get sidetracked doing lots of fancy tech projects that are very sort of cutting edge, but don't actually tackle the basics, right? If you don't get the program component, you don't need a chatbot, right? So we are sort of focusing on let's get the basics right. Let's get the program there. And then let's harness the power of technology and AI to make it easier for governments to scale quality coaching, but not replace it, right? But like really focus the humans on what the humans do best.
And stepping back a bit, Bruck's scale and reputation in the development space, I think, makes it a candidate to be in line to receive some of this new wave of funding that's potentially set to arrive from particularly US philanthropy. There was a much read article recently called The Third Wave of American Philanthropy that talked about kind of this inflow of money that could be on the horizon. Could you see Bruck tapping into that if we were thinking really ambitiously? Do you think some of that could be channeled to the governments that you work with in order to provide them with funding for the work which you're advising them to scale up?
Yes, I think private funding can massively help de-risk the uptake of graduation programs for government. Also, I think it is a really important thing to discuss and think through, right? And the way we try to always have these conversations is that to say that for every sort of dollar spent on philanthropic funding, they can expect to unlock many, many more times of public funding from governments, right? So it's a catalytic funding, and it is often a little bit more flexible and tangible, and allows this way of operating that I have been describing, right? So I think it's definitely something that that is really helpful, that has also allowed us to operate in the way we have been operating. And that also, if connected to this unlocking of public funding, provides a really great return on investment for the funders themselves, right? Because the entire way of working that I've been setting out is really that through providing this funding and this technical assistance, we unlock many, many more times public funding, which is paying for all of the program components, paying for all of the people involved in the implementation, right? So I think it is a really big thing. And graduation remains just one of those programs that anyways is, you know, always comes up in these lists of sort of best buys. And to your second part of your question, yeah, I think it would be great if some of that also reached governments directly, right? We know that in the shocks with the cuts in development aid, but also the various wars, a lot of governments are struggling with funding. And I think I think it would be a good thing if some of this also reached governments directly and supported some of this implementation.
And to finish, given the various roles you've played in this ecosystem, I was wondering if for those researchers and practitioners listening who are thinking about or already partnering with governments, what are your reflections on being an effective government partner?
Firstly, I mean, working in the background is really important, right? I think if you want to be an effective government partner, you need to enable government to lead and work at its pace, right? Then the second one is the designing for government delivery and financing. This sounds very generic because everyone says they're doing that. But this is linked back to that point I made at the beginning, right? We need to really think through what is realistic, what capacities are there, and design for that, not design for what we think government can be persuaded to then fund. Really from the beginning, plan for that. The third one is embracing sort of iterative improvement over time, which might be necessary sometimes, right? Traditionally, you design the perfect thing on paper and then you start to implement and then you deal with your implementation challenges. As I was trying to explain here, very often we are supporting programs to get better over time. And as long as there's agreement on what needs to be reached, what a quality program is, then I think that is fine, right? But it is a bit of a different way of working. Then augmenting, yes, but really augmenting, focusing on building capacity and phasing out and the sustainability of what needs to be there in place, right? And linked to that, really trying to avoid building parallel structures, but working on system strengthening, right? Strengthening government capacity, strengthening government delivery system, strengthening government technology, all of these type of things. And then I think, and this is we're very privileged to have been in this position, we have been able to operate flexibly, right? And that goes back a little bit to your funding question just now, right? If we and other organizations are able to work more flexibly, it's easier to really live this idea that government is driving, right? If you have milestones and log frames that you're chasing and so on, you're very limited in your ability to work flexibly and work at the pace that government wants to work, right? So I think continuing to have these debates also in the funding community and try to raise understanding and funding for this type of flexible work is really important. And then finally, obviously, also to the researchers, that exist, focusing really on helping address some of these gaps around the how, right? And really generate evidence on how governments can do this scaling and support that research agenda and the use of evidence and understanding what those gaps are. I think that is another sort of key thing that where there's more to do.
Stephanie, thanks so much for your time. This has been Ideas in Development. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed today's episode, give us a like or a 5-star. And all of our past episodes, as ever, are available at voxdev.org.